This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, the scenes we've seen, and most people will have seen them, on the Polish border of migrants trying to get into the EU, thousands of migrants from the Middle East on the border between Belarus and Poland, and indeed between Lithuania and Belarus also, but to a lesser extent, are distressing. It's a human rights issue. And it was described yesterday by the chief diplomat in Brussels, the EU diplomat, Josep Borrell, as a hybrid war almost being waged by the Belarusians. And of course, perhaps complicit in all of this is Vladimir Putin. It's causing distress, of course, to the migrants, to the Polish border guards, to the Polish people. And also of interest in Europe this week is the proposed meeting on Friday between Lord Frost, the British representative, and Maros Sefcovic, the EU negotiator. And this, of course, is about Britain's dispute with the EU over the Northern Protocol. We're joined now from Brussels by Naomi O'Leary, the European correspondent of the Irish Times. Naomi, the trouble on the border is distressing for the migrants, of course, and also it raises all kinds of questions that really a few months ago, as Josep Borrell said, were really unimaginable, a kind of hybrid war being waged by migrants with the support of Lukashenko and perhaps also Vladimir Putin.
Hi, Eamon. It's great to be with you.
Thanks.
I think it's really important to say that the principal actor in this, as what's described as an act of hybrid war by the EU, it's not the migrants themselves. It's this dictatorial regime of Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus.
Yes.
And what he's accused of doing by officials is orchestrating essentially a traffic of people. So there are, officials say, travel agencies in Middle Eastern countries, in Baghdad or Istanbul, where Belarusian travel agents will arrange tourist visas, travel and transport for people with the sort of implicit promise or understanding that then they'll be allowed to travel on into the EU. So those people are brought to Belarus on the Belarusian state airline, it said, and then moved towards the borders of the EU, Poland, Latvia and Lithuania, where people have been gathering in increasing numbers because the border forces on the edge of the EU are not letting them advance. They're not letting them cross into the EU, whereas Belarusian forces are not letting them go back. So they're stuck there. These people have been used as tools by Lukashenko to put political pressure on the EU, because the European Union sanctioned his regime because of his crackdown on pro-democracy protesters. So it's led to these horrific scenes on the border of people making makeshift encampments out of branches, making little campfires, trying to keep warm in temperatures that are going below zero at night.
Yes.
Small children among them, you know, families. And tensions spilled over yesterday when some of the young men began throwing stones at the Polish border guards trying to break through. They've gathered in quite large numbers, according to the Irish Foreign Minister, Simon Coveney. About 18,000 people have been brought into Belarus this way.
Yes.
And the European Union's foreign ministers have been meeting to discuss how to respond to this.
Yes, I mean, the chief diplomat in the EU is Josep Borrell. He said, and you quote him in your piece in the Irish Times today, is saying, this is something, a situation that even a few months ago would have been difficult to imagine. And as you describe it there, and as you indeed describe it in the newspaper this morning, it's a horror show, but highly orchestrated, with planes transporting these people from the Middle East, dropping them on the border or somewhere close to the border of Europe. And it's really testing Europe, and it's testing the resolve, in particular of Poland and Lithuania, at a time when there are tensions between Brussels and the Poles anyway. But this is an entirely separate matter, isn't it?
Yeah. If you think about the role that particularly a country like Lithuania plays here, Lithuania has been home to the exiled opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya.
Yes.
And it's also been a really prominent sort of advocate of the Belarusian opposition. This is extremely irritating to the Belarusian regime. So the Lithuanians very much see this as retaliation, deliberately causing a problem on their border. And similarly with Poland. Now, the response of the EU has been not to back down with sanctions, but actually to increase them. So just this week, the foreign ministers agreed to extend the sanctions to cover what's expected to be a number of airlines and anyone who might be involved with that system that I described of bringing people in through travel agencies and so on. One of the companies that's expected to be hit is Belavia. And now Belavia is the state airline, and it has a fleet of 30 planes. Of those, 17 are actually leased by Irish companies.
Yes.
So they're leased out of Ireland. So these contracts are expected to be hit by this. Now, it means that you're going to have potentially planes stranded over there, because if you suddenly have contracts interrupted in acrimonious terms, it can be difficult to get the planes back. So there could be a sort of financial hit to Irish companies. But I think it's really important to point that out, to show that although this is happening on the eastern border, it's very much intertwined, you know, with the whole EU involved and links to Ireland as well.
Yes, and it raises questions about the degree to which Lukashenko is supported and sponsored in this endeavour by Vladimir Putin and Russia. There's no question that there is a relationship between Russia and Belarus. To what extent did people believe them to be complicit in this endeavor?
It really depends how suspicious you are. So the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, is the most powerful ally of this regime of Lukashenko.
Yes.
A rare ally and a powerful one. And what we heard from the EU's chief diplomat, Josep Borrell, yesterday was that he doesn't believe that Lukashenko could do this without the support of Putin, that it's sort of a necessary condition.
Yes.
Then again, you know, it's not necessarily the case that the sort of spooky hand of Putin is behind everything. You know, this guy Lukashenko clearly acts in quite dramatic ways. He's the guy who was responsible for downing a Ryanair flight.
Yes.
In order to pull people off it who he wanted to arrest, opposition figures. So, you know, he's probably his own man in his actions, you know.
Yes.
However, there are some Eastern member states, particularly the Baltics, who have raised fears that there is some sort of broader strategy going on here. Estonia has been concerned that this isn't isolated, that there are deliberately tensions being stoked on the border in the context of something wider that's going on.
Yes.
Particularly pointing to suspicious troop movements on the border of Ukraine, where there's been a Russian military buildup, and the United States has been warning that, you know, they're concerned about a potential repeat invasion of Ukraine, like what happened in 2014, and that, you know, could have kind of, this is some sort of a distraction potentially, is the theory. But these are very much suspicions to which we, you know, we don't have evidence. And I'm sure the Russians would refute this.
Yeah, the situation being, when you look at the geopolitical situation, America in isolationist mode to some extent, in full isolationist mode perhaps, when Trump was president, but and less so with Biden. But right across Europe, there are also tensions between Poland and Hungary, for example, and Brussels. And even in NATO, we're not sure about the major players and the relationship because Trump backed away from support of NATO. In terms of the EU's security, Naomi, which is really the most obvious and visible threat, the security of the border is of paramount importance, the first thing any nation or alliance of nations has to do. Is this raising questions about Europe's capacity to protect itself and to protect its member states from the kind of aggression that would suit Putin, particularly in this new, less comfortable and certain geopolitical world?
I think that challenging actors on the borders of the EU have identified some nice things about the EU and are trying to exploit them as weaknesses.
Yes.
One of those would be open borders.
Yes.
Like there are open borders within the EU, but that does mean that you can create tensions between member states.
Yes.
If people are crossing borders from the periphery into the EU, or indeed periphery states can get annoyed if they feel that they're left to deal with too many people who are arriving on their own. That's one thing. Another thing is the sort of humanitarian traditions of receiving people as they should be under international law and processing asylum claims. This is being used not just by Belarus, but also historically by Turkey.
Yes.
To create problems for Europe and to create something that's sort of logistically difficult to deal with.
Yes.
But is also very divisive for the population. It splits opinion between people who want a hardline response and those whose instincts are more to help the poor people who are being used in this way, the vulnerable families who are trying to flee violence and make better lives for themselves.
Does the EU, I mean, do people in the EU depend, if this gets more serious and becomes a permanent feature, this kind of hybrid troublemaking, is NATO the defender of last resort in these circumstances?
I think that it's seen as part of a spectrum of new tactics which fall short of sort of traditional military aggression.
Yes.
That are used to test NATO and to test what's the red line and what can really be deemed, you know, an aggressive act insofar that it would trigger retaliation. There's loads of different examples of this, these kind of tactics, whether it's cyber attacks or...
China would be menacing Taiwan, for example. And it appears...
That kind of thing.
Yes, that as the West engages in disputes with among themselves, as geopolitically the West is not comfortable with many things, the UK withdrawing from the EU is a good example, that this offers an opportunity to the authoritarians, the autocrats.
Yeah, that kind of flyover, the incursion or threatening to encroach on airspace, that would be another example. And there are differing points of view within the EU about what the response should be.
Yes.
Pretty much everyone agrees that there's good case for improving cybersecurity, although that's not necessarily the simplest of all policies to address, because part of the reason is that the private sector outcompetes the state in terms of their ability to attract the kind of talent that you need for cyber defense. Then there are also plans afoot in the EU to do this sort of wide-scale strategic review of defense, which covers all of these sort of hybrid grey areas as well as the more traditional areas of defense. And that's part of what defense ministers were discussing this week in Brussels. They laid out a strategic plan The headline of it is that there would be a rapid intervention force, a pan-EU intervention force that would allow the bloc to sort of jointly respond to crises. But, you know, it remains to be seen whether that will come actually to fruition.
Yeah, I mean, if it existed, it could be on the Polish-Belarus border now, assisting the Poles, I assume.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Let's move on to the British EU dispute. On Friday, Lord Frost, formerly David Frost, is going to Brussels, I understand, to see Maros Sefcovic, the EU chief negotiator. Sefcovic earlier this week welcomed a changing tone from Mr. Frost, but Mr. Frost has been very belligerent, and we are facing, in some people's estimation, the possibility of a trade war, which would be triggered if Britain were to unilaterally declare Article 16 redundant.
Yeah. Speaking to Simon Coveney this week, he has said that this step back by David Frost is a window of opportunity to potentially try to find a solution, and that he believes that if both sides are actually willing, this could be solved by Christmas, that the problems are not so great that they couldn't be overcome. I think the suspicion is that the British government is not raising objections to the Northern Ireland Protocol on purely grounds of, you know, practical difficulty in Northern Ireland, but that it uses this as a political tool, that it for some reason likes to stoke conflict with the EU for internal political reasons.
There's plenty of internal political reasons, as I'm sure you know, Naomi, to distract people. And a row with the EU is a good distraction, particularly if it's over the European Court of Justice and its role in being the arbiter, the ultimate arbiter in the single market. There isn't any room for compromise for the EU over the role of the European Court of Justice, is there?
No. On the ECJ, it's just a necessary condition of Northern Ireland being part of the single market.
Yeah.
It's not something that can change, because you can't have a different kind of law reigning in one part of the single market and not in the other. That's part of what makes it a single market, an interoperable area where businesses can understand that the same rules apply in all parts of it. So that isn't an area where the EU can compromise without, you know, the Northern Ireland Protocol just ending, or, you know, and then it's just the same problem again of where does the border go. What the negotiators hope, I think, is that if they can come up with solutions for all kinds of issues on the ground to make it as seamless as possible and as light touch as possible. So stuff to do with customs codes and medicines and,
yes,
you know, all of these sort of like technical areas. If they can find solutions to all of that and then leave this ECJ issue to the very end, I think then they hope that by that point, you know, the momentum towards solving this will be greater. Because remember, this objection to the ECJ is a kind of recent thing. It didn't come up during the initial agreement of the protocol. It's new. It's a new objection.
Yes.
It came up during the summer. So, you know, they're hoping that it will, just as it appeared, will go away again.
Yeah, and then they might be hoping that, it seems to me that if we don't want a border on this island, that's really what is the natural outcome of what the British demand is. They don't want a border down the Irish Sea. If it isn't there, then there's only one other place it can be to protect the single market.
On the border, yeah, or between Ireland and the rest of the EU.
Yeah.
Between Ireland and France.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the stakes for us here are massive, aren't they, Naomi?
Yeah, very big. And also because if the British government does go ahead and use Article 16, the EU member states are pretty clear that their reaction will be strong and far-reaching. And it will probably affect overall trade with the UK.
Yes,
it's like a no deal type situation.
Yeah, and sorry to interrupt you there. I just wondered how solid the 27 are behind Ireland's position, or let's say it's the EU position, but a position they're taking to support Ireland and also to protect the single market.
Yeah, there's unusual unity on this issue as ever. It has a kind of strange magic ability to unify the EU27 in a way that almost no other topic does.
Right. And just a final question, Naomi, in the light of what are very unsettling matters, whether on the border of Poland, Lithuania, maybe Latvia, the row with the British government and the general instability that's been injected into Western political thinking, is the subject of the EU's ability to protect itself and to protect its security and also its values, is that in the discussion now in Brussels? I'm thinking of things like not just a rapid reaction force, but a European force that would have a meaningful impact when trouble arrives.
Yeah, that is very much on the agenda. The French presidency starts soon, at the end of the year.
Yes.
And this is a big theme for them. That's something they want and they would like to see progress on. They've called a big summit on this issue of defence. And so all of this sort of preparation is building up to that. This context in Belarus and Ukraine is kind of helpful,
yes,
to that discussion. It's helpful for those who want more robust EU ability to sort of defend its interests, you know,
yes,
through hard power rather than just soft power. But it is worth mentioning the soft diplomatic power of the EU as well, though, because in this particular circumstance, what the EU has been successful in doing is sending diplomats to the countries where those people were being taken from.
Yes.
Places like Iraq, and explaining what was going on to those governments and getting them to stop flights to Minsk. So they've been successful in doing that. They've halted the routes from the countries where people were being flown in from.
Yes.
Which has helped to reduce the numbers going in massively. Iraq is also arranging evacuation flights from Belarus for those of its citizens who want to leave now.
Right.
Because all those people are just stuck there, you know.
The final question about France's pretty hardline position on the EU being able to defend itself and perhaps have an army and a way of doing that. That would be a polar opposite. Ireland would be very much a dove in that situation, wouldn't it? And internally here, whenever the question of a European Union army or any of that, there's outrage, particularly on the left. Mm-hmm. So that would be, France is at one end of that spectrum, and Ireland traditionally has been at the other end. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, Ireland has a special opt-out, so it doesn't need to be part of any of this. It has it's sort of exempt. It's one of a number of neutral countries in the EU that have those exemptions. I think also it's worth pointing out that over time, the idea of defence in the EU has evolved. So maybe 20 years ago, when there was conflict in the Balkans, the idea of a joint EU force was something that would have tens of thousands of soldiers in it.
Yes.
Now they're talking about something with maybe 5,000. And that even that is considered like really ambitious. Also, they did have something like that already agreed, not exactly the same, but something called battle groups. And they were formed, but they were just never used because the political will isn't there. You know, people aren't that interested in sort of overseas conflict. So the I think part of the way that the current defense strategy is being designed is to focus not just on this sort of like traditional troops idea, but on all of these more gray area issues. So stuff like maritime, space, cyber.
Yes.
These sort of more, these other frontiers of conflict.
Okay, Naomi, thank you very much for joining us from Brussels. Naomi O'Leary is the European correspondent for the Irish Times, and we're grateful to Naomi. To all of you for listening, that's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.